A long look passed between Houdini and Mephistopheles, and the ringmaster finally nodded. Despite logic telling me all would be well, my palms tingled when Houdini maneuvered himself into the vessel. Either for our benefit or his own, he took a large breath before submerging himself. Liza and Isabella were on the can in an instant, securing the lid in place. At the same moment the lid clanked down, Mephistopheles started the clock. It seemed they'd practiced quite well. This was one science experiment they could not get wrong. Not only for Houdini's sake, but for the fate of the carnival. Tick, tick, tick. Once more, I dragged in my breath along with the crowd, holding it until I convinced myself my eyes would burst from my skull if I didn't release it. Tick, tick, tick. The second hand echoed like a gong, all the while Houdini remained below water. Tick, tick, tick. More gasps burst forth from people in the dining saloon. 48 seconds had now passed with the escape artist still submerged. Liza and Isabella shifted, their pretty smiles frozen in place. Tick, tick, tick. Mephistopheles called out,
1 minute.
Thomas tapped along to the ticking of the clock, the sound setting my nerves into more of a tizzy. I clamped my jaw together until it ached. At the minute and a half mark, Liza and Isabella casually lifted the domed lid. Houdini burst upward, hands still shackled, and drew in a ragged breath. Water splashed onto the stage, the sound not even close to as lulling as the waves outside. Houdini drew in a few more deep breaths, eyes twinkling.
This time, instead of just a demonstration, my assistants will also padlock the lid, making escape nearly impossible. I'll either set myself free.
Mephistopheles walked over and patted his shoulder.
Or we shall set your corpse out to sea.
A few patrons stood and quietly left the room. Light from the corridor flashed each time the door opened and closed, the illumination adding to my twisting worry. Houdini dunked underwater, and Liza and Isabella secured the lid, this time padlocking it in two places. While they did that, the ringmaster started the ticking of the clock. It took nearly 30 seconds for the lid to be locked. Surely Houdini would be exhausted after already demonstrating the act. It was beyond madness to do it again so soon. This was a death wish. My heart knocked frantically, searching for a way out. There had to be an explanation for the trick, but I couldn't locate one. This time, Liza and Isabella covered the milk can with a curtained screen. It was midnight blue velvet, with 1,000 silver stars embroidered onto it. Tick, 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 tap, tap, tap. I couldn't decide if Thomas's tapping or the incessant ticking was worse. Mrs. Harvey twisted her napkin in her lap, eyes fastened to the starry curtain. Tick, 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 tap, tap, tap. I moved about my seat. There were so many more pressing things to be concerned with. The severed limb, the slain women, the identity of the murderer who might be in this very room. Yet my pulse roared at the possibility of what was happening behind that curtain.
Tick, tick, tick. 1 minute, 30 seconds, Mephistopheles said.
I had no idea if I'd imagined the strain in his tone. Passengers grumbled as the clock ticked on. What had started as good fun was turning into panic. A few people pushed back from their seats, fists clenched at their sides.
Tick, tick, tick. 2 minutes.
Mephistopheles's foot tapped faster than the clock. Both Liza's and Isabella's arms began trembling, the curtain wavering with them.
2 minutes, 30 seconds. Help him, a man cried, followed by another. Release him!
Something must be wrong, another passenger yelled.
The crowd grew uneasy. More pleas cropped up. Still, the ringmaster kept his focus stuck to the ticking second hands.
3 minutes,
he nearly shouted. Sweat beaded his hairline. Either he was the most talented actor the world had ever known, or something was going dreadfully wrong. I stared at my cousin, noting the way her eyes kept darting to the clock. By now, almost everyone in the crowd was on their feet, yelling, demanding action. I was about to jump on stage and open the bloody can myself, when Mephistopheles yelled,
"Check him now!"
The curtain dropped in an instant, revealing a soaking wet, unshackled Houdini. He bowed deeply as the crowd went utterly wild with applause and whistling. "I don't believe it," I muttered. "How on earth did he manage to get the padlocks back onto the can?"
Thomas opened his mouth, but Mrs. Harvey silenced him with a look. "Not a word out of you, dear, or I swear I'll finish my story about poor Mr. Harvey and his underthings." I'd never seen Thomas snap his jaws together faster. I wanted to smile, but found it nearly impossible as my gaze caught on Houdini's. There was something in the gleam of his eyes that made all the hair on my arms stand at attention. I'd thought for certain he'd be the next victim, and I had a troubling feeling he knew it.
29. A Frightful Discovery. Third Class Promenade, RMS Etruria, 7 January, 1889. Wind bit at my face, stinging my eyes and making them water as I hurried along the abandoned deck of third class. At this hour, the sun was a mere gash on the horizon, tinging the water a crimson black as it spilled across the waves. I shut images of bloodbaths from my mind, moving as quickly as I could to the temporary laboratory. A noticeably pale servant had delivered a note from Uncle that had stated, "You're needed in the laboratory, straight away." I'd thrown on a simple muslin dress and stuffed my feet into the first shoes I could find. Dainty little silk things that would have to do, though Thomas would certainly raise a brow at them, as he'd done in the past. His teasing didn't matter, swiftness did. There was an aura of urgency in the air, and I couldn't help but inhale it in great gasps, setting my limbs in motion. I didn't need to possess Thomas's skill in deductions to know a body had been found. Uncle wouldn't send for me this early if it were about the severed limb. A thorough dissection had already been completed, and in truth, there wasn't much else we could do with it. This was something worse, much worse. Another blast of Arctic air barreled through the corridor, forcing me to bury my nose into my fur collar. The storm that had been threatening was almost ready to wage its assault. My steps rushed over the deck, the wooden slats cold as the winter air frosting the railings. A prickling sensation between my shoulder blades brought me to a halt, glancing back down the empty deck. At least I believed it remained vacant. This early in the morning, before the sun actually rose and the sky was somewhere between blood and shadow, it was hard to tell who might be lurking against the wall. I stared a beat more, then turned and continued on. When I came to the entry to the stairs, I paused again, listening for any sound of pursuit. Waves steadily lapped the side of the ship. Wind howled low through the tunnel-like deck as it gusted. Steam hissed far above from the funnels, or smokestacks as Thomas called them. No footsteps, though. I was alone with my conjurer of an imagination. Without thinking, I touched the blade hidden on my thigh. No matter how tired or in a hurry I'd been to forgo finding proper shoes, I'd made sure to not leave without a means of protecting myself. One fact remained. A person on this ship was snatching victims as if they were pearls plucked from oysters, and stringing them up in horrific ways. I'd not be taken without a fight. Satisfied I was alone, I plunged into the dim lighting of the narrow stairs, beads of perspiration already beginning as I descended deeper into the overly warm belly of the ship. New sounds emerged. The loud machinery of the boiler, constantly being refilled to power our journey across the sea. A horribly familiar scent also unfurled its fingers, beckoning me to the source the closer I drew. The sweet stench of human rot permeated the space, made worse by the heat of the boilers. I thought of Mephistopheles' plague masks, wishing I had some herbs to smell now. Anything would be better than a nose full of decomposition. I finally reached the bottom of the stairs and nearly ran down the corridor, slipping as I swung into the laboratory. Uncle glanced up, his face grim. As I'd suspected, a shrouded body lay on the examination table before him.
Uncle, I said by way of greeting. I took a breath to steady myself and entered the room. Thomas hadn't arrived yet, though I imagine he'd be joining us soon enough. It took a moment, but the strong odor of death settled into an uncomfortable backdrop, hardly occupying space in my thoughts.
Prepare for the post-mortem. I want to examine the heart, stomach, intestines. Or what's left of them, at least.
Uncle handed me an apron.
We'll begin soon.
Yes, sir. I strode over to Uncle's medical bag, removing the tools needed for this full examination, one by one, and laying them out in a row on a tray. Bone saw, toothed forceps, rib cutters, scalpel, enterotome, skull chisel just in case, and a Hagedorn needle to sew the corpse together.
The hammer with the hook is in the side pouch, Uncle said, tying his own apron and rolling up his shirt sleeves.
I nodded, setting about retrieving it while he scrubbed his hands and arms with carbolic soap. We were creatures of habit, he and I, both finding peace in our post-mortem rituals. A set of hurried footsteps brought my attention up as Thomas practically leapt into the room. He hadn't bothered with the jacket, and his white shirt was rumpled and mostly untucked, as if he'd fallen asleep in his clothes. Even when we'd been investigating the secret tunnels below Bran Castle, I hadn't seen him so disheveled. From the look of him, it didn't appear that he'd been in bed for too long before being roused. I wasn't sure I wanted to know what had kept him preoccupied. A muscle in his jaw ticked as his eyes lifted from the covered corpse and met mine across the room. We'd known it was only a matter of time before another body turned up, but it didn't make it easier to deal with. I offered him an encouraging nod, hoping he'd read the sadness in my own expression. Our chosen field of study showed the dark side of life. It was difficult to not be pulled into its void. The day death became easy to accept was the day I needed to set down my blades. Judging from the expression on his face, Thomas felt the same.
I apologize for the delay, Professor.
He produced a notebook and pen, situating himself near the examining table.
Miss Wadsworth?
He tipped his chin in formal greeting.
What have I missed?
We're just getting started, Uncle replied, moving to stand over the cadaver. They found the body in the cargo hold approximately 35 minutes ago. It had been stuffed into a wooden crate.
He removed his spectacles and pinched the bridge of his nose.
The smell drew the attention of a crew member, and he alerted the chief officer. This one is a bit different from the others. Prepare yourselves.
I swallowed the bile searing up my throat. Uncle had been taking meticulous notes for more years than I'd been alive, adding to theories and scientific findings of other doctors, such as Dr. Rudolf Virchow, who'd developed standardized post-mortem protocols. Both men had found putrefaction in the air, occurring 2 or 3 days after death. Intense odors, such as that from the corpse in this room, would be present by the 5th day. Meaning Miss Crenshaw might not have been the first to die after all.
Let's begin.
Uncle pulled the shroud down, revealing a discolored female body, naked except where he'd covered her with strips of cloth. It was one of the last decencies she'd been shown. Her murderer certainly hadn't been kind or careful with her person. My gaze swiftly traveled down in assessment, then froze. Slashes were apparent on her throat, and her torso had been split open. More precisely, she'd been ripped open. I held in a gasp at the brutal state of the victim. Uncle was right. This murder was unlike the others. The previous victims, while horrid in their own right, had been slain quickly. Their bodies sustained the most damage post-mortem. This woman had been stabbed and slashed while she was still breathing. It almost seemed as if an entirely different person had attacked her. Which couldn't be. Everything in the warm room suddenly became too hot to bear. I took a few breaths, hoping to steady the erratic beat of my heart. Jack the Ripper was dead. There was no way this crime was done by his hand. Yet the similarity of the wounds was striking. Part of me wished to toss the medical tools on the table and run. Run far away from this corpse and these violent murders that never seemed to end. But on this ship, in the middle of the great Atlantic Ocean. There was nowhere to escape. Death didn't disturb me. Memories of the Ripper case were a different matter altogether, though. Thomas bent near.
It's an equation, Wadsworth. Find the clues and add them together.
I jerked my head in response, emotions cooling. I set the tray back on the table and gave my uncle the measuring tape. Outside, I was as sturdy as the ship, while inside I churned with emotion like the waters we sailed through. I wasn't sure the Ripper case would ever leave me in peace. Uncle measured the body from foot to crown with efficiency, then reported to Thomas.
Deceased is approximately 162.5 centimeters, shoulder-length brown hair, Caucasian. Estimated weight is between 8 and 8.5 stone.
I wiped down the scalpel and handed it to my uncle before he asked for it, then prepared the toothed forceps.
Greenish discoloration is present in the middle of the abdomen.
He gently prodded the closed eye, checking to see if it yielded, and I tried not to wince as he pried the lids open. For some reason, the examination of the eyes was my least favorite part.
Eyes are milky and slightly protruded, he said. Conditions in the cargo hold are moderately warm to cool. From outward examination, I'd place the death between 72 and 96 hours.
Our external examination was complete. Now it was time to unearth clues left by the murderer. Uncle pulled the skin taut on the collarbone, pressing his scalpel until the skin split in its wake. He repeated the movement on the opposite side before dragging the blade down the center, completing the Y incision. Though, with the torso ripped open, he didn't have much to slice into below the ribs. Once Uncle cracked the sternum, I clamped the rib cage open without being asked. He grunted approval, high praise considering his attention never wavered once the post-mortem began. Up this close, the odor was strong enough to cause a few stray tears to slide down my face. I rubbed my cheek against my shoulder, then collected a specimen jar in case Uncle needed it.
Lacerations are present over the intestines, both large and small.
He leaned closer until his nose was a mere hand space away from the exposed cavity. He took the scalpel and carefully moved the muscles away.
Ribs show marks from knife blades. Victim was stabbed repeatedly before being partially eviscerated.
A strong indication that whoever had committed this murder had been enraged. This was no random crime. There was too much passion and anger involved. Uncle drew back, dabbing at the sweat on his brow.
The nicks in the bone are similar in appearance to those found in the severed limb, though closer inspection with a microscope will be needed to be conclusive. They're also reminiscent of wounds left by Jack the Ripper. Strikingly so.
We all paused for a moment, not wanting to utter the impossibility of that aloud.
Thomas, is there a problem?
Apologies, Professor.
Thomas's pen rushed across the journal, capturing each word and detail with the same precision Uncle used to carve the dead. I forced myself to focus on his quick, sure movements. I came back into the procedure as Uncle sliced into the stomach, revealing more clues as to time of death.
Contents are mostly digested.
He removed his rust-colored hands and peered at me over his spectacles.
What might that mean, Audrey Rose?
Time of death would have occurred between meals. I leaned over the cavity to get a better look. Uncle stepped aside, ever the professor of forensic medicine. If I had to guess, I'd say it indicated she'd been murdered very late at night, or in the early morning hours before her first meal.
Good.
Uncle poked around the empty stomach, making sure we'd missed nothing.
Now we'll just need to find out who else has been reported missing to the captain. Her clothing is folded up there. Someone ought to recognize it.
I followed his gaze to a pile of tattered and worn garments. Judging from the tears and patches, she wasn't a first-class passenger. Her life had likely been hard, and she did not deserve to have it ended in such a callous manner. Dread pulled my shoulders down. Dissecting a cadaver on a slab of cool metal was hard, but not impossible. Attaching names and a life to a victim, however, was impossible not to feel.
"Shall I say what we're all thinking?" Thomas asked. "Or does this crime not seem disconnected from the others to you?"
Uncle glanced back at the body, expression shuttered.
"We will treat this as we treat all cases and make no assumptions either way. What else have you deduced?"
"Since this corpse is female and is in possession of all her limbs, we have another problem."
Thomas closed his notebook, then stood beside me.
"There is still another body out there. Have all the crates been searched in the cargo hold?"
Uncle shook his head.
"Captain Norwood felt uncomfortable with that."
I rubbed my temples, doing my best to ignore the pulsing anger.
"So our captain would rather wait until the next victim's stench coats the corridors of the ship? It's bad enough that he refuses to ask Lord Crenshaw to comply with our investigation, and he is very sensitive to Dr. Arden's need to remain locked up in his rooms. But when will he worry about the victims? Unless he doesn't want these crimes to be solved, perhaps he's the man we're searching for."
Thomas paced the perimeter of the small room, tugging at his collar. I'd been so consumed with the post-mortem, I'd forgotten how warm it was down here. He moved one way, then the other, constantly in motion, much like his thoughts.
"His arrogance is an ugly quality, though I don't believe he'll hang for that."
He stilled.
"The ringmaster is charming, brash, utterly full of himself, and has excessive taste in dramatics."
"Those traits, while annoying, don't mean Mephistopheles is our murderer," I said. "If not the captain or ringmaster, then who else?"
Thomas stuffed his hands into his pockets. "I'd say Gian is too obvious, though still a decent suspect. And the amazing Andreas is quiet enough to be terrifying. His type is the one that taxidermies animals and secrets them away in hidey holes. Though maybe we've been focused on men, when we should consider our murderer might be a murderess."
"A knight of swords, a fool, a hierophant, an escape artist, a ringmaster, and now either an empress or an ace of wands," I said, prattling off each of the performers' stage names. It was truly remarkable that we could all maintain straight faces while naming potential murderers. "Out of those, you believe a woman is our killer?"
Thomas pulled his pocket watch out. "Whoever is responsible, we need to figure it out quickly. Once we reach American shores, our murderer or murderess will slip from our grasp."
30. Greatest Trick of All. Mephistopheles' Workshop, RMS Etruria, 7 January, 1889. I lifted my hand to knock when the door to Mephistopheles' workshop swung open, startling both myself and the unsuspecting Andreas as he walked into me. The fortune teller took one look into my face, then threw his hands up, stumbling backward.
"Don't hit me, miss, please. I told you the magic looking glass was better than the tarot. You didn't listen."
What? I asked, unsure if I ought to be offended. "Have that many people smacked you after a reading? I thought we were friends. I've been practicing that card trick, the snap change one, remember?"
Mephistopheles chuckled from somewhere in the cabin behind him, and Andreas's face scrunched up.
"Take heart, my friend. If you'd brought out that wretched looking glass, she'd have kicked you."
The ringmaster appeared in the doorway, clapping a hand on the fortune teller's shoulder.
"One glance at that filthy glass sends all the wise girls running for maids and cleaning supplies. Now then."
He turned on his performer.
"Give her back her brooch and be on your way."
I felt around my cloak, realizing the pin was missing. "How?"
"Here."
Andreas thrust the brooch at me and snatched his cloak from the hook near the door and huffed.
"The looking glass divines the future, and there is nothing wrong with it. It's an antique. The patina gives it character. The spirits enjoy it."
"Whatever you do," Mephistopheles said, "do not repeat that rubbish to Harry. You know how he feels about those who claim to speak to spirits or tell the future. And how many times do I have to tell you to not steal from patrons? It's bad for business."
"Harry Houdini is a fool, and she is not technically a patron anymore, is she?"
Andreas gave the ringmaster a haughty look before dashing into the morning light.
He gets a bit sensitive about his Bavarian portending relic.
Mephistopheles motioned for me to step inside before shutting the door. Dust motes moved like glitter in the shafts of thick morning sunshine.
I bet he stole the thing from some tiny shop in a nameless German town.
That's what you want to comment on? What about my brooch? I swung around, head cocked. Does Andreas have a habit of thievery?
No, he makes a living at it.
He walked over to his work table and fiddled with some pieces of mechanical cage he'd been making.
Before you ask, I've already checked his chambers for clues or knives or other murder ephemera. Everything was a mess, but no blood or bodies.
Well, I don't trust him.
A wise deduction on your part. For that matter, you ought to be terrified of me.
From his tone, I didn't think he was entirely joking.
Rumor has it that another body was discovered this morning. Is that why you're blessing me with your presence?
How do you know about it? I asked. Have you made other midnight bargains with spies?
Jealous.
He glanced at me over his shoulder, a smile tugging one side of his mouth up.
Your cousin told me when I saw her this morning. She'd found a note you'd left in your room.
Oh. It was a simple enough explanation, though I didn't know quite what to make of it. Why did you need to speak with my cousin so early?
I take it you finally gave her Harry's letter.
He turned fully in his chair, eyeing me.
She was quite touching. Hardly the mark of a girl blissfully in love with her suitor. I also apparently annoyed her by knocking on your cabin door like a... How did she phrase it? A stray cat in heat, I believe, was the charming term.
He smiled.
She threatened to have me neutered. Imagine that.
For some silly reason, my cheeks warmed at the thought. Why were you calling on me so indecently early, then? He looked at me like I might be a bit dull.
To invite you to breakfast. Though I thought better of it once I'd discovered where you were. Dissection and tea don't sound all that appealing, though maybe your tastes are a bit more depraved than my own.
I rolled my eyes.
Tell me.
His tone was suddenly serious.
What did you discover?
I hesitated, unsure of how much information might be too much to share. For all I knew, I was standing in the room with the very man who'd murdered all those women. How well do you know the people who are part of your carnival?
How well do we truly know anyone, Miss Wadsworth?
Don't start equivocating. I crossed my arms. If you'd like to hear my theories, you need to participate in being helpful. Tell me who you trust and who you don't. We need to narrow down the suspects. Any information you have might be of use.
I do not have the luxury of trusting anyone.
He pointed at the mask he wore.
If I did, I would not keep myself hidden like a common thief. Do I believe in the people who work for me? I do. I believe they are all unique and wondrous, and horridly misunderstood. I also know that they all have a past, most of them criminal.
Even Anisha? I asked, skeptically. She was lied to and taken from her home and family. I have it on good authority that you were the one who made that bargain.
Is that all she said about her past? Interesting.
He motioned for me to take a seat on a settee that was piled high with bolts of fabrics and costumes. Reluctantly, I did.
Would you care to hear a story, Miss Wadsworth?
I did my best not to show my impatience. Everything was a riddle with him. Will it be beneficial to the case?
Eventually,
he said,
but it may take a moment to arrive there.
All right, then. Tell me.
My grandfather taught me his best trick,
Mephistopheles said, surprising me with an actual family detail. There was a wistful expression in his gaze that made him seem like any other young gentleman, except for the cursed mask. He shook his head.
Though I doubt my father would be pleased to hear it.
What did your grandfather teach you? He offered a smile tinged in sadness.
To dream.
I drew my brows together. That wasn't at all what I'd been expecting, which should have been expected, coming from Mephistopheles. Yes, But was he also good at engineering? Did he show you how to craft trick hats and boxes that saw people in half? Surely that's more valuable in your business than a simple dream.
The greatest trick of all is dreaming without limits.
Everyone dreams, Mephistopheles, I said. There's no trick to it. The ringmaster stood and picked up a toy-sized hot air balloon. He beckoned me to come near and lifted it into the air, watching it hang prettily between us, all pale blue stripes, crescent moons, and tiny pearls. Up close, I could see the little wicker basket had been woven through with silver thread.
Dreams are strange curiosities, he said, eyes still on the balloon. Sure, everyone possesses the ability to lay their heads down and imagine. But to do so without limitations or doubt? That is something else entirely. Dreams are boundless, shapeless things, given strength and form from individual imaginations, their wishes.
He looked at me, then reached out and removed my hat pin.
All it takes is one shard of doubt to wedge itself into them.
He swiftly stuck the balloon with my pin, and the air whooshed out as it descended to the ground.
And they deflate. If you can dream without limits, you can soar to great heights. Let the magic of your imagination set you free.
Does your grandfather approve of your carnival? I asked, hoping it wasn't too rude of a question. Or is that why you wear a mask? To hide? Mephistopheles stared down at the ruined balloon.
My family does not desire to know a thing about my show. They purposely act as if neither it nor I exist. As the spare heir, I was never required to be the good or decent one. I simply needed to be there in case the unthinkable happened to their favored son.
There was no trace of bitterness that I could detect, though his words were brutally harsh in their honesty. Part of me longed to reach over and comfort him, while the more sensible side refrained from acting on the impulse.
My grandfather passed away, and my father withered. He is still alive, he amended, but my brother mostly runs the estate. It was best, they said, if I didn't displease my father with my useless dreams while he recovered. My follies were for swindlers and other low-born thieves, things I supposedly needed to be extra wary of, since my mother is from Constantinople. They worried about society speaking even more poorly of me than they already did.
I'm sorry. My heart clenched. My mother, being half Indian, had occasionally faced similar prejudices from small-minded people. I know how hard it is to desire approval from your parents, even if it's the last thing you truly want. Mephistopheles rubbed at his mask, but didn't take it off.
Yes, well.
His voice was a bit rough.
Now you see why that signet is so important to me. I might have been a disappointment to my family, but I'm not quite ready to give them up. My grandfather insisted I have it once he passed on, and it's my last link to him.
My hand went to the heart locket around my throat. I would go mad if anything happened to my mother's necklace. I recalled the longing in Mephistopheles' eyes when Thomas had produced his signet. If it were me, I'd have throttled someone until I got it back. Why didn't you tell anyone your family ring was missing? He smiled, but it was more fierce than sweet.
I do not need anyone learning my true identity. Who knows what sort of blackmail might be used, should my name be discovered? The carnival folk are brilliant, but they're also practical. They need coin, and earn it any way they can.
You believe Gian or Andreas stole your signet, then?
I'm not certain who stole it. They are all dear to me, but I have no idea how deep some of their own scars go.
That's terrible.
That's life, my dear.
He lifted a shoulder.
They are the dregs of society, the throwaways and so-called freaks. When that's beaten into you by others, you tend to stick to yourself and live by your own code. Who can you trust when the whole world turns so savagely on you? And in the name of what? Because we choose to live by our own rules? Because a young woman would prefer to cover herself in ink instead of silk? Or because there's a person who enjoys swallowing flames in place of mucking out alleys in the East End.
His hands clenched at his sides.
I can no more blame them for biting the hand that feeds them than I can ignore the fact that society kicked them until they learned to strike back at anyone who dared to get close. We might band together, but we will always be apart, too. This carnival is home for now, but it won't be forever for some. There's always a grander dream or larger goal to achieve. This is the cost of dreaming without limits. This is the dark side of show business.
I thought of one act in particular. Like Houdini? Mephistopheles retrieved the broken balloon and tossed it into a rubbish bin.
Like him? Like Gian? Like Anisha, Andreas, Cassie, and even Sebastian? We are all together, brothers and sisters, in this madness. Until we're not. I don't relish thinking of them as thieves or scoundrels, or even murderers, as you might suggest. Not when that's how so many others view them. But the fact remains, I do not have the luxury of casting anyone aside. Though I am more inclined to believe it's someone who's not part of my troupe. I don't know much about the captain, but he is. I'm not sure. He seems out for glory. I don't know what he'd do with my signet, or why he'd murder his own passengers. But I also can't say he wouldn't have stolen it or killed those people, or had one of his crew members do the deeds for him. Perhaps he dreams of owning his own ship. My signet would fetch a decent price. And if he ends up saving the day by finding the true murderer, well, then he'd be called a hero, wouldn't he?
I thought dreams were good things, I said, thinking to the start of our conversation.
Ah, yes, but you cannot forget, nightmares often begin as dreams.
If this dream has become such a burden, why not quit? You have the ability to walk away. I'm sure your family would gladly welcome you back. He gave me a sad smile, and I thought perhaps it might be the truest thing I'd ever seen from the illusionist.
If only it were so easy. You see, you create an escape for someone else, realizing too late that you've trapped yourself in a cage of your own design. By then it's too late. The show has taken on a legend of its own, and you are powerless to overcome those bars. So you submit to your art and allow the world to consume you, knowing the cost. Each performance siphons a bit more of your soul.
Sounds pleasant, but do you still enjoy it?
You want me to remove my mask for you, Miss Wadsworth? You want the truth?
Then it shall be yours. He stepped close to me, but I didn't back away.
You both love and hate it, this ravenous beast that feeds until you're nearly spent and never thinks of giving back. But you cannot fault it. You understand its selfishness. You were once selfish too. So you make excuses for it, nourish it, love it, coax it into a monster so large it will never be satiated with what you give. You either must end it entirely at the risk of yourself, or carry on until the last curtain falls and you take that final bow.
A tear slipped down my cheek. That's incredibly sad, Mephistopheles.
That is the nature of the show. It never truly ends, only slumbers until it wakes and does it again. The performers you see out there,
he gestured toward the door,
they do not belong anywhere else. They have no home other than the one under the stage lights and striped tents. The show is home, and we are all much too indebted to its shelter to leave it behind.
All of you feel that way?
The fire eater? The swordsman? The gentleman who nearly drowns each night? Do you believe they'd be welcomed into the circles you belong to?
He shook his head.
Society scorned them, turned them into freak shows and curiosities. And now they're only interested in cheering because of the glamour of those velvet curtains, the allure of magic and mysticism. Should they encounter those same performers on the street, they would not be so kind or accepting. It is a sad truth that we do not live in a world where differences are accepted. And until such a time, Miss Wadsworth, I will provide a home to the misfits and unwanteds, even if it means losing bits of my soul to that hungry, unsatisfied beast Mr. Barnum has called show business.
I wasn't sure what to say. There was so much more at stake for Mephistopheles than I'd have thought. So much each and every person involved with the carnival stood to lose. They were a family of discarded souls, lost until they'd found a home with each other. It would destroy them if one of their own was the monster they so desperately tried to keep out of their reality. A chosen family who dealt in dreams and was living a nightmare. My chest ached. I did not want to break any of their hearts, but I couldn't turn away from the crimes. If the murderer is a performer, I sighed, it would be better if the carnival didn't hinder the investigation. And I don't mean better for me or my uncle, I added at the flash of incredulity in his face. I know you take care of your own, but if word spread of you harboring a murderer, it will destroy everything you've built. Beast or not, this show will come to an end. Mephistopheles took a shuddering breath.
If I tell them to turn on each other, it will end badly no matter what.
He shook his head.
Enough of all that. Is Mr. Cresswell planning on returning my signet any time soon, or is he prancing around at night wearing it, wishing he were as handsome as me?
I blinked at the abrupt change in subject, but didn't press the issue. I will make sure you have your ring back.
I knew I liked you with good reason.
With that, he offered his arm.
Come, it's almost time for breakfast. I'm sure Mr. Cresswell would enjoy spending time with you before the show tonight.
I hesitated before taking his arm. I was under the impression you'd want to keep me from Thomas as often as possible.
Don't think I've gone and done the valiant thing now, Miss Wadsworth. I'm still the same scoundrel you met a few days ago.
A bit of mischief was back in his eyes.
I simply want to steal you right out from before him.
I didn't bother responding. Let Mephistopheles believe he could pull off the biggest sleight of hand. I knew there was no one who possessed enough magic to spell me away from Thomas Cresswell. At least, I believed that to still be the truth. But in a world where illusions were hard to distinguish from reality, it was getting harder to tell. 31. Method of Distraction. Bow, RMS Etruria, 7 January, 1889. Jian tossed jewel-encrusted daggers into the air, handle over blade, in rapid-fire succession, juggling them as if they were no more dangerous than apples or oranges. It seemed far too early to be so cavalier with a weapon like that. He watched my reaction from the corner of his eye, mouth pressed into a flat line. He'd made it perfectly clear he did not care for me or my presence in his carnival, though my only crime thus far had been to exist, as far as he knew anyway.
Is that what you'll be teaching me this morning?
I asked, hoping I sounded as unaffected as he looked. Or will I be playing a different role in the finale? No one's told me what exactly I have to do. Andreas glanced between us, sinking his teeth into his lower lip.
Actually, he held a long, thick ribbon up, his expression a bit sheepish. You'll be standing against that board, wearing this for now. I'm not sure about the finale. Mephistopheles hasn't told anyone what we're doing yet.
I followed where he pointed and shook my head.
No. Learning how to throw a knife or wield a sword is one thing. Standing blindfolded against a board as a target is quite another. That's sheer madness.
Jian quirked a brow.
Are you scared?
I whipped around to glare at him. Clearly he was either under the influence of the Green Fairy again, or he was utterly insane.
Of course I'm scared. Any person with an ounce of logic would be. You want to throw daggers at my person, and you don't like me.
I have very good aim.
I pointed to myself to accentuate the point. And I ought to simply trust that you won't miss on purpose?
Andreas shifted beside me. Would you like me to go first?
You're going to blindfold yourself and let him throw knives at you? I shook my head. You're all mad. Absolutely, uncaringly mad. As crazy as the idea was, however, it was hard not to recall the precise way Miss Prescott had been slain. How the knife had unerringly found its target and severed her spinal column and pierced her internal organs. If Gian was as good as both he and Andreas claimed, then there was truly no way I'd stand there and offer myself up like a sacrificial lamb. I blew a breath out. Logic told me it was dangerous and to run from the room. But I needed to do this. If not for me, for Miss Prescott. Time was running out, and I had to gather as much information as I could. If we didn't discover who was behind these murders, he or she would slip into the bustling New York streets and get lost within the cacophony forever. Witnessing Gian's throwing abilities firsthand would benefit my research. Fine. But if you miss, Mephistopheles won't be pleased. Gian's stony expression didn't change, but I could have sworn there was an added sparkle in his gaze. Without further comment, I turned on my heel with as much dignity as I could inject into the movement and marched up to the target board. Andreas tied the blindfold around my head, then bent to whisper,
"I'm sorry for stealing your brooch earlier. It's a trick I'm still working on. I swear I would have returned it to you."
"Make sure Gian doesn't slip, and all will be forgiven." He patted my arm and adjusted me so I was standing in profile against the wooden board. I didn't so much as breathe too deeply when he stepped back and Gian yelled out,
"Get ready!"
My palms tingled. I swore I suddenly needed to either use the loo, or sneeze, or scratch some phantom itch on my arm. My muscles were so tightly locked, I started to think that maybe they weren't still at all, but shaking from the effort of not moving. Before I could work myself into true hysterics, I felt the swish of air near my ankles, followed by a thwack as the blade drove into the wood. I exhaled and nearly sagged with relief. It was a good thing I hadn't had time to take a deep breath. In rapid-fire succession, three more blades whizzed by my body, embedding themselves into the wood with splintering efficiency. One near my knee, the next just below my hip, and the last one near my ribs. "Fire!" Gian shouted. I sincerely hoped he was throwing the last of his blades, and that I hadn't magically found a way to self-combust from fright. Thwack, thwack. Two more blades flew by, the slight breeze of them startlingly close to my sleeves. Grateful this so-called lesson was over, I made to remove my blindfold, when another knife sailed through the air, pinning itself into the ribbon I held. Warmth dripped down the side of my face, and I ripped the rest of the blindfold off, eyes wide, as I lifted a hand to my ear, and it came back wet with blood. Gian shook his head.
"I warned you not to move."
Without so much as an apology, he gathered up his knives and left the practice room, leaving Andreas to fuss over my superficial cut. As he raced around the trunks, searching for a bit of cloth to dab the remaining blood, I couldn't help but wonder what other messes he might clean up for Gian. I crossed my arms over my chest and planted my feet solidly. "There is no good reason for you to hold his signet hostage, Cresswell."
"I disagree. Respectfully so, Wadsworth."
Thomas lifted his chin, stubborn as a mule.
"It may be useful as evidence. We cannot simply give it back because he asked nicely."
I gritted my teeth. "You're being immature and know it. This has nothing to do with the case, and everything to do with your dislike of Mephistopheles." Something that appeared close to annoyance flashed in his eyes.
"Is that what you think of me now? That I'd withhold someone's possessions out of jealousy?"
I lifted a shoulder. "You haven't given a better reason for keeping the ring."
"You're getting too close to this case,"
he said, inspecting me.
"Whatever bargain you've made, it's time to break it. We'll solve the murders another way. You needn't be so involved."
"I'm sorry, Thomas, but I have to see this through." He shook his head. Before he could say anything more, Uncle and Liza hurried around the bend, spotting us near the bow and increasing their pace. Tear streaks glistened down my cousin's cheeks in the late morning sun, setting my emotions in a flurry. Abandoning my disagreement with Thomas, I rushed forward, clutching her hands in mine. "What happened? What's wrong?"
"It's Mrs. Harvey,"
she half-sobbed. She's missing.
What? Thomas's voice rose before he reined it back in. Have you checked her cabin? She's always napping.
Uncle shook his head.
It was the first place we'd looked. We also checked the breakfast room, saloon, women's parlor, and the starboard promenade.
Chills whipped down my spine with the breeze. Surely she must be somewhere. We've searched everywhere. Liza's lower lip trembled. She's simply gone. Without a parting word, Thomas took off running down the deck, a hand clutching his hat as he raced toward his chaperone's cabin. It took every bit of restraint I possessed to not go charging after him. I could not fathom what his emotions were. He'd never said so, but Mrs. Harvey was the closest thing to a mother he'd had, and he would be broken if anything happened to her. My own heart ached at the thought of her meeting a wretched end. I quite loved Mrs. Harvey and her traveling tonic and kindness. A dark feeling slithered through my core. If Mrs. Harvey was missing, that could mean the murderer had specifically chosen her to inflict the most damage on my friend. If Thomas was rendered unfit to use his skills, whoever killed those young women might go free. While I didn't want to think Mephistopheles was to blame, it was the sort of cunning plan he'd come up with. He'd already manufactured a lion attack for reasons I still didn't understand. For all I knew, he might have also left his signet in the sword container, hoping Thomas would take it. Was each odd detail something painstakingly thought out, wished for, all leading to emotional entanglements and missed connections? I held my cloak tighter and looked around. Hardly anyone was out today, either too afraid of the bodies that kept being found or of the impending storm. Let's hurry. I clutched Liza's hand and moved quickly down the promenade, hoping I didn't sound as scared as I felt. Uncle was two steps behind. Tell me everything, from the beginning. How did you discover she was missing?
We were to eat breakfast together, Liza sniffled. I promised to give her a tour of Harry's equipment and introduce them afterward.
Her voice trailed off almost subtly, making me wonder what she wasn't saying about Houdini.
She was so excited, I cannot imagine her missing it. For some reason, she kept asking if he'd be practicing for another aquatic act.
That certainly sounded like Mrs. Harvey. I patted Liza's arm, trying to steady her without causing further distress. The motion also helped keep me calm and focused. I needed to remain in control if Thomas fell apart.
Were you to meet her at our cabin or hers?
We were supposed to meet outside the breakfast room at 8:15.
Liza drew in a ragged breath.
I was running a little late myself, but by 9:15 I decided to check on her rooms. I wasn't sure if she'd overslept. When I got to her room and knocked, no one answered.
You weren't in our cabin? I asked. Liza shot me a look but didn't elaborate. Uncle kept pace behind us, remaining silent but watchful. It was impossible to discern what his feelings were. Unsurprising, since he was the man who'd taught both Thomas and myself the importance of divorcing emotions from both murder scenes and investigations.
I went to fetch you, but you were out, so I ran to Uncle.
She glanced over her shoulder, either assuring herself he was still with us, or hoping he'd not overheard my earlier question of where she'd been.
I found him en route to the captain, and we started searching everywhere.
I tried not to let my own fear show. It would have taken something extraordinary to keep Mrs. Harvey from being introduced to Harry Houdini.
She's probably chatting with one of the other ladies. You know how distracted she gets.
I could no longer tell who was pulling the other down the promenade faster, Liza or myself. We rounded the corner and practically ran to Mrs. Harvey's cabin. The door was ajar, and Thomas was standing in the center of the room, fists clenched at his sides.
Have you?
He held a hand up.
One more moment, please. I'm almost...
He abruptly walked over to her trunk and popped the lid open.
Her cloak is missing, as are her gloves. There's nothing out of place, which means she was likely interrupted on her way to breakfast.
How did you know where she was going? I asked.
He hadn't been present when Liza offered that information.
There, the tea in the cup on her nightstand is ice cold to the touch.
He pointed it out.
Under the saucer is a paper with this morning's date on it, meaning she'd had the tea delivered when she woke up.
Since there's no sign of a meal, it's not a stretch to assume she was heading to breakfast with your cousin. She is acting as a chaperone, so another easy deduction.
Now then. He spun on his heel, eyes darting over everything once more.
Who would have enticed her enough to not send word of her being late?
I felt Liza's awe fill the space. Uncle's was there as well, but was a bit more tempered, as he'd witnessed Thomas's deductions firsthand several times. For Liza, it might be akin to seeing a circus monkey speak English, or perhaps watching a magician who truly could make miracles happen. Thomas was every bit as incredible as the ringmaster, if not more so. Mephistopheles was amazing at engineering tricks, but Thomas unearthed truth by using his intellect.
"Come," Thomas said, abruptly moving out the door. "Let's pay a visit to Mephisto. Wadsworth, lead the way to his lair."
We rushed past third-class passengers who crowded the deck, my pulse galloping faster than any racehorse, the closer we drew to the workshop. There were many more people out than I'd seen on our way to Mrs. Harvey's cabin. Some of them appeared stricken, faces pale as the frost creeping up the ship's railing. My body thrummed with warning. Something had happened. Something that created an uncomfortable buzz and a glazed-over look of worry. Or was I simply imagining things? I slipped over a section of slick walkway, and Thomas's hand shot out, steadying me. I gripped his arm, noticing Uncle had also taken Liza's as we picked up speed. Each step forward filled me with more dread. Once at the workshop, I dropped Thomas's arm and banged on Mephistopheles's door, the pounding more frantic than my heart. I waited a breath, then knocked again, this time louder. The vibration reverberated up my arm, and I felt it deep within my bones, but I couldn't stop myself from banging again and again. We had to find Mrs. Harvey. I couldn't imagine. Thomas carefully wrapped his hand over mine, stilling me.
"He's not here, Audrey Rose. It's all right."
I stared at the closed door, jaw clenched against the tears that were threatening. Mrs. Harvey needed to be all right. I sucked in a deep breath, composing myself once again. The cool air helped soothe the rising panic. "All right," I said. "Let's head down to the carnival cargo area. Mephistopheles..."
"Dr. Wadsworth!"
We all jerked our attention toward the sound of the ringmaster's voice. I wasn't comforted by the expression on his face. It was more wild and frenzied than I'd ever before seen, even half hidden by a mask.
"Please, come quickly."
Mephistopheles skidded to a halt, then swung back in the direction he'd come from, not waiting to see if we followed. Thomas looked half mad with worry, but kept whatever he was thinking to himself, guiding me into the stairwell after Mephistopheles as quickly as my bulky skirts allowed. Instead of descending into the belly of the ship, we climbed the stairs up and up, the sounds of our shoes clomping over the metal and ringing both above and below. Uncle and Liza brought up the rear, while Thomas and I practically clutched at Mephistopheles' scarlet coattails. I'd ceased to be surprised when we re-emerged on the first-class promenade and headed straight toward the music room. Mephistopheles had addressed my uncle rather than me, which wasn't promising. Without preamble, he threw the door open, thankfully revealing a sobbing Mrs. Harvey in the corner, hanging tightly to a very pale Andreas. Gian loomed behind them, his expression as stormy as the churning sea. If he were a god, he'd be wrath incarnate.
"Mrs. Harvey!"
Thomas rushed to her side, dropping down to his knees, examining her for any wounds or trauma. Liza let go of our uncle and assisted Thomas. My own emotions calmed at seeing Mrs. Harvey alive, though terribly shaken, her whole body vibrating with tremors, and her lips moving silently in either prayer or comfort. I immediately switched into scientist mode, attention falling over every object in the room, while Thomas tended to his chaperone. The tarot cards Mephistopheles had painted, the Cirque d'Eclipse, were scattered across the floor. The magic looking glass lay propped against the wall where I'd seen it last, appearing no worse for the wear.
"There,"
Mephistopheles told my uncle and me,
"in the trunk."
Uncle pushed his spectacles up his nose, his expression harder than the polished wooden planks we stood upon. I steeled myself as well. Coming upon a body
Any place other than in a sterile laboratory was always a challenge. We were scientists, not monsters. I crept over to where the trunk sat alone behind a tower of